Twilight in the Green Zone by David Wellington. An Iraqi boy of maybe 7 was pushing his way between the tables, holding both arms up in the air. He held something flat and shiny in either hand, and he was chanting in a sing-song voice. Viner dropped his feet to the floor as if to jump up, but Holcomb just laughed. Holcomb had been in Baghdad for most of a year now, and Viner, who had arrived just a few weeks previous, was taking his cues from the British bureaucrat. The boy came closer, shaking his wares in the air. Viner could understand what he was saying now. "Latest movie," the boy muttered. "Julia Roberts, very good, all pretty." He was holding up DVD boxes. A private contractor near the front of the shop put down the hookah pipe he'd been sucking on and waved the boy over. The contractor had a submachine gun looped over his arm, and he had to move it aside to take a wad of dollar bills out of his pocket and pay the boy. "You're a tad jumpy, Yank. Thought that kid had a bomb, didn't you?" Viner scowled and scratched his mostly shaven head. There had been an attack just that morning, a rocket fired at the presidential palace. There was a system to deflect those, but it had failed. The rocket had gone right over the wall and stuck the side of the building, and though it hadn't exploded, it had still destroyed an office suite and killed 2 Iraqi nationals, the housekeeping staff. "There's no safer place in Iraq than right here." Viner knew it was true. The Green Zone. The American elite officially called it the International Zone, but even among the troops it was green. Was a region of central Baghdad centered around Saddam Hussein's former presidential palace, a narrow little strip of land down by the river that had been walled off completely from the real world. No one got inside without being properly vetted. No vehicle came inside without being thoroughly inspected for explosives. Viner was in less danger in the Green Zone than he would have been driving on I-95 back home. There's a bit of a bang now and again when they pitch a mortar shell over the wall, but no one's ever hurt. Hardly ever. "Come on, have some more of this." Holcomb poured some liquor from a silver flask into Viner's iced tea. Viner pushed the drink away. It wasn't the threat of violence that had him worked up, not really. He didn't think Holcomb would understand if he tried to explain. He felt as if his skull were itching, under the skin where he couldn't scratch it. The heat didn't help. It was 2 in the afternoon and well over 100 degrees outside. In the shade of the hookah bar, it was merely unbearable. Outside, it would burn the flesh right off your bones. If Viner didn't get some release soon, he was going to lose control. Go apeshit, and that wouldn't be good for anybody. He got up from the table and threw some coins to Holcomb, who caught them and tucked them away in his shirt pocket. He muttered some weak excuse, said he'd find the Brit later for dinner. Outside, he kept to the sharply defined shadow of the palace wall as he headed back toward his hotel room. He passed by Saddam's pool, blue and shimmering and very enticing, but it was full of Marines. Big teenagers with shaved heads and dog tags around their bare necks. A female version was up on the diving board, built like some kind of efficient machine in a khaki one-piece. Her hair was frizzy and high around her ears, and she was clutching herself across the chest, laughing wickedly as the boys in the pool begged her to show them her tits. Viner put his head down and moved on. Hundreds of people, Marines, diplomats, a tiny contingent like himself from the UN, the ubiquitous private contractors in aviator sunglasses and ballistic vests all crowded into a little square mile of the city. So many hormonal teenagers, men far away from their wives, women so outnumbered by men they could take their pick, all with nothing much to do but think about sex all day long. It tortured him, twisted him up, disgusted him, made him feel unwhole. And yet it could work for him. It could feed the thing inside him. He'd promised himself it would never happen again, that he would never do it again, but it was the only thing that could make him feel human, the only cure. He pushed back against the bright white marble wall of the palace and felt it burn his back, but even that mild pain couldn't calm him down. He squeezed his eyes shut. "Please," he thought. "Don't let it go so far this time. Don't ask so much of me." He needed to find a girl. He needed to find the right girl, exactly the right girl, or it wouldn't work. She had to be perfect or do nothing for him. When he opened his eyes, he was looking right at her. Directly before him stood an open-air DFAC, a cafeteria with long tables set up under a generous expanse of camouflage netting. At that moment, it had only one customer, a woman of maybe 25 years. He couldn't look away from her. Beautiful was his first thought. Skinny was his second. Long and graceful of limb, with olive skin that looked as delicate as the undersides of the leaves on the trees in the desert. Black hair hung down on either side of her face, the upcurved ends tickling her breastbone. Her hands were small and fine-boned as she lifted a sandwich to her mouth and bit into it. She chewed silently for a moment, then put down the sandwich and looked up at him, as if she just noticed him staring. Her eyes met his, and he felt like cold water had been dumped down his back. Adrenaline flooded out of his kidneys and made him shake. Her eyes were deep black pools. She was looking right through him. She knew. Just like the others, the 2 girls he'd found back in the States with eyes like that. They had seen into him. They had known. But not for very long. Viner would have given anything to be able to look away then, to walk away. If she looks away now, he told himself, I won't do her too. I just won't. Somehow I'll control it. She didn't look away. Unable to believe what he was doing, equally unable to stop himself, he walked over to where she sat. Holcomb had told him he could do this. Walk up to anyone and just start talking. It was too hot in the zone to be alone with your thoughts for long, something he understood perfectly. Everyone was desperate for company, for conversation. He took a seat across from her. A waiter in a red vest and a bow tie asked him what he wanted, and he muttered something about a cheeseburger, but he was still looking right at her. My name is Namash, he told him. Had he asked? He couldn't remember. I work as a secretary for the CPA, and sometimes, too, as a translator. You are a banker? He must have been talking the whole time. He must have said something, but he couldn't remember. Viner's mouth was dry. His tongue stuck to the roof of his mouth. I work for the IMF, yeah, he said. You're a native? I mean, an Iraqi? She was the one. The next one. She smiled and agreed. I've lived in Baghdad as long as I can remember, she said. I feel like I've been trapped here so long I can't imagine anywhere else. She looked up into his eyes again. His arm tensed up and started to twitch. You must be very rich, yes? She asked with a laugh. All bankers are rich. I do all right. Viner opened his mouth, started to warn her. Something else came out. Your city is very beautiful, he said. This? She asked. She rolled her eyes to indicate the palace behind him. The zone in general. This is not my place. This is Saddam's foolish dream. He wanted to be respected by Western leaders. He wanted to be one of them. Instead, he made this swollen eyesore and was mocked for it. No, I am sorry, sir, but you have not even seen my city. I'd like to, he bluffed. I'd like to get out there and see the real thing. Baghdad had no appeal for him whatsoever, but admitting it wouldn't impress a local, and he suddenly wanted very much to impress her. They could have been any two young people. They could have been flirting mildly or just passing time. At least until she looked at him again. Do you have quarters here? He asked, maybe a little too forward. He needed to play this cool or risk losing her. And now, after she'd seen inside him, he couldn't let that happen. She knew what he was. He could feel it. She knew his shortcomings, knew that he was made with a piece left out. He had to make sure she never told anybody what she knew. Oh, no, I have a place outside the city, in the desert. It's quite lovely, though small. She smiled at him, her eyes downcast, her hands balled in her lap. There's a garden and a fountain. I'd love to see it, he told her. It sounds great. Perhaps someday, she demurred, turning a little away. The waiter brought his cheeseburger and he picked at it. He wasn't hungry. It took 3 days to woo her. He brought her flowers, roses from Damascus, shipped in on a C-130 Hercules. He brought her the very first glass of wine she'd ever tasted, a Malbec from Argentina. French vintages, while not strictly prohibited, were hard to find in the American-controlled green zone. He waited for her every day at sunset after her work was done for the day and drove her in his issued car down to the Assassin's Gate, where protesters shook signs in Arabic and English at him and ignored her altogether. She tried to tell him all about her life, and he listened politely but retained little. She had a sister, she said, who was in prison. She would like very much to see America someday, though she wasn't sure she could ever get out of Iraq. He told her very little about himself and why he was in Iraq. Once he almost slipped up. I wanted to get away from a certain temptation. I thought it would be easier here, but... He caught himself before he went any further. Most of the time he kept control, kept himself to himself. Instead he offered her small compliments, careful not to be too suggestive. In this, as in so many other things, Holcomb had been his guide. Got yourself a bird, the bureaucrat had asked with a wry grin. You gotta be careful with the native wildlife. They're skittish and shy, but the rumor is, he said, leaning in close until Viner could smell the whiskey on his breath. Once you get them alone, they're all over you. You can't get enough after being repressed so long. Viner didn't want Namal all over him. He wasn't sure if he'd even be able to perform if it came to that. He just wanted to get her alone for a while. It was near sunset on the third day when he finally got his chance. He'd been hinting for a while that he'd like to take her back to his hotel room, where it was cool and they could talk in private. At first, the very suggestion had made her blush. He'd had to change the topic quickly. That day, however, she had looked down at her clenched hands and muttered that it might be all right for just a little while. It had been easy. It had been easy before, too, with the two American girls who had looked at him like that. He took her hand, which made her blush again, but she didn't pull away, and led her through the streets to the Al Rashid Hotel where he was quartered. Just a little longer, he promised himself, and it would be done. She wouldn't look at him like that anymore. She wouldn't be a danger to him. A sore temptation to just grab her and drag her into an alley rose inside of him, but he could handle it now, so close to culmination. No one would miss her. Other than her imprisoned sister, she had no family to come looking for her. Her employers would notice when she turned up missing, but they probably wouldn't even launch an investigation. Local workers disappeared from the green zone all the time, and no one ever asked any questions. The hotel's lobby was a cool expanse of marble and soft light. After Gulf War I, Saddam had put a mosaic of Bush Sr. on the floor so everyone who entered or left the hotel would have to walk over his face. American troops had smashed the mosaic and put a new one in with Saddam's own face in its place. He led her inside. She hung back while he went toward the reception desk to get his key. She was probably embarrassed, worried that the desk clerk would know why she was there. It was fine with Viner. Best if nobody saw her come in on his arm. He took the key and started heading back to the front door where he'd left her. There was a sudden rattling noise behind him, and he was nearly knocked down by a Marine in full combat armor. The Marine muttered an apology but didn't slow down. More troops came in from the lounge and from the street entrance. A full squad came clattering down the stairs. "What's going on?" the desk clerk demanded. The Marines ignored him. Viner pressed himself up against one wall, unsure of what he was supposed to do. "Officer," Viner said, when a lieutenant in a capot helmet burst through the door. "Lieutenant, what's happening?" The officer stopped in front of Viner and looked him up and down. "You a guest here? Can I see your ID, please?" Viner fished his UN card out of his pocket. The lieutenant nodded at it. "We had a report of a bomb on the 12th floor. Probably nothing." Viner's blood turned cold. "My room's on 14. I need to get up there." "Not till we've checked this out," the officer told him. "Like I said, it's probably nothing. Maybe you want to find someplace else for the night, though." A glance toward the door showed him that Nama had fled. Probably wise. The Marines would question any Iraqi they found near the hotel. But he'd been so close. The need inside him burned, literally burned in his stomach. He could feel his insides crisping, turning black. "You all right, sir?" the lieutenant asked. "I have to go," Viner told him. His voice sounded suspicious even to his own ears. There was nothing for it. He broke and ran for the door. The lieutenant called after him, but nobody tried to stop him as he burst out into the light and heat of afternoon. He found Nama a street and a half away, cowering in a shadow. She couldn't look at him when he called her name, but she didn't pull away when he grabbed her arms and spoke soothing words to her. "Perhaps this is for the best," she said finally. "It was a foolish idea." "Your place," Viner said, desperate, inspired by need. "You said you would show me your place out in the desert. Why not today?" She looked at him then, and she saw right through him. He knew it. She saw her own fate in his eyes. If she said no, he would try to back down. He would let her go, never bother her again. If she said no, he would fight himself at least another day. He would get control somehow. Maybe he'd cut himself across the arm with his butterfly knife. That usually helped. If she said no... She smiled. Her eyes still pinned him, bore into him like laser beams, but her mouth smiled. "Maybe," she began. "I'll get my car and meet you at the gate in an hour," he said. She knew what was coming. She wanted it on some level. He'd know she would. "He has a lady friend he'd like to, escort home," Holcomb said, licking his lips and looking towards the door. Clearly he didn't like doing this favor. Viner felt for him, but didn't have any choice. The contractor, Viner had not caught his name, frowned and put one booted foot up on a bench. "Home. I take it her home is in the red zone?" Viner frowned. "What? Where's the red zone?" The contractor smiled. His eyes were invisible behind the ballistic lenses of his mirrored Oakley Fives. "This is the green zone, where you're safe, right? The red zone is where you're not safe." "Where is it, though?" Viner demanded. "Everywhere else." The contractor shifted his machine gun onto his hip. Holcomb coughed politely. "He'd like some advice, if you'd be so kind, about what he should do out there. How he should, roll. I've got to say, this is one shitty idea you got, pal. Real shitty. We go out there, we take a vehicular escort, that's maybe two up-armored Suburbans and hopefully a pickup with a machine gun mount, 50 cal. We have people pulling rear security, and we got a saw gunner watching the crowds. Anybody who gets too close, we warn them off. They keep coming, we throw flashbangs, we start shouting. They come closer, and we just waste them. That's how we go outside. And that's if we go out during the day. At night," he said, leaning forward, "we make sure we've got real backup, like air support. It's just about to turn into night right now. Did you notice that?" "It's not very far," Viner promised. Actually, he had no idea how far away Nama's house might be. "And once I'm there, I'll be safe. You can't..." He looked at Holcomb for reassurance. "You can't stop me." "Shit, no, I don't have that kind of jurisdiction." The contractor drew a pistol out of a holster at his belt. Viner jumped back, thinking he was being threatened. Instead, the contractor spun the weapon in his hand and then handed it to Viner butt first. "But I wouldn't let my pet dog go out there unarmed. Just do me a favor, all right?" Viner nodded. "They'll probably send us out tomorrow to pick you up, so if you're going to get killed, do it someplace close by." More advice followed from Holcomb, most of which amounted to the fact that Viner should get out of the city fast, get inside somewhere secure, and stay there for the night. He tried to tell Viner about all the threats he would face and how to counter them, but Holcomb was handicapped in this by the fact that he'd never been outside the wall either. Viner picked up the fund's requisitioned car, a blocky little Italian-built sedan, and got underway just before the sky turned yellow with evening. The amplified voice of a muzzin calling from a high minaret somewhere out in the city rattled his nerves, so he turned up the radio and listened to some Iranian pop station. He couldn't understand the lyrics, but the tune was all right. At the Assassin's Gate, which Nima claimed was an invented name, an American name for something the Iraqis just called the Palace Gate, the soldiers manning the checkpoint shouted and waved at him and threatened to blow out his tires. One of them whistled at him and ordered him to back up. Viner pulled out his UN identification card and waved it at them. Their faces fell when they realized they couldn't issue him direct orders, but they just shouted all the louder. "Sir, we cannot stress how dangerous," one yelled, while the other was saying, "The Hajis are restless tonight, sir. We can't let you. Can't guarantee your safety once you leave this perimeter. Against official policy of the Coalition Provisional Authority. Nobody goes out, not if we can help it," the first one sighed. "You let her go," he said, pointing through his windshield to where Nima stood, waiting for him in the middle of a crowd of protesters. "Sir?" the soldier at his window asked. "Her, the girl there in the sleeveless blouse, the one who's not wearing a headscarf." "Don't know what you're talking about, sir. Nobody's gone out this way since this morning, since they found that bowl." Viner stared through the dusty glass at Nima. She bit her lower lip and looked scared. Did the soldiers not even see her? Had they reached a point where they didn't even notice the locals anymore? Then he did a double take. "Wait a minute, what are you talking about? What bowl?" At the Al-Rashid Hotel, they found a bowl somebody left in the hallway by the elevators where you might step on it when you walked out. Thought it was a bomb. Turned out it was just a plain old bowl with a bunch of stuff written inside in Haji language. Viner fumed. He could have taken Nima in his own rooms. He could have skipped all the guns and dire warnings and general annoyance. Instead, somebody had left their dirty dishes in the hall and the entire hotel had to be locked down. "Listen," he said, "I'm going out there, now." The soldier looked at his partner, glanced down at his weapon, a black plastic assault rifle with a bunch of dangerous-looking gadgets mounted on it. Then he slapped the roof of the car two times. "Yes, sir." He pointed forward towards the checkpoint, and two more soldiers ran out to move aside a sawhorse. Viner rolled out into the crowd of shrieking, banner-waving, chanting, and crying protesters. Holcomb had told him the secret was to keep moving, though very slowly, and the people would be forced to get out of your way. He shoved the passenger door open, and Nima leapt in. She bent down and low in her seat and covered her face in her hands as if she were afraid to be seen. Viner kept the car moving, and the protesters surged and fell back, and then he shot out into the street beyond like a cork out of a champagne bottle, out into the red zone. The Iranian pop star on the radio stopped singing, and the station broke in with an hourly news brief in Farsi. Viner didn't understand a word the announcer said. Viner had read The Arabian Nights growing up, and he'd seen plenty of Sinbad movies. He was completely unprepared for 21st century Baghdad. For one thing, it was a city, a modern city, not entirely unlike the one he grew up back in the States. Most of the buildings were big square slabs of glass and steel, marble and concrete. There were palm trees lining the sidewalks, but they had those in California, too. The differences were subtle and took longer to notice. A lot of the buildings, even the high-rises, had no lights in their windows. There was plenty of electric light on the street, even though darkness was just falling. Signs in Arabic lit up in neon and less garish colors. Open-air cafes where men sat huddled around tiny tables talking animatedly amongst themselves. It was crowded, too, extremely so. Baghdad had more people than Houston, crammed into a much smaller space. The street was full of cars moving just fast enough to reassure Viner he wasn't sitting in a parking lot. Hordes of people were pushing their way along the sidewalks, bobbing around one another or strolling sedately. The men were in Western dress or in a traditional clothes, galabeya or dishdasher robes, their heads covered in keffiyehs. The women wore headscarves and sometimes veils, though there were very few of them on the street near the gate. The children kept their heads bare. There were a lot of children. They smiled and waved, and some ran toward the car shouting friendly questions. Viner waved back and found himself pleasantly surprised. This wasn't so bad. Once they were well clear of the gate, Nima sat up in her seat again and stared out her window at the city going by. She was gawking like a tourist, frankly, or as if she'd been away from the city for a very long time and was surprised to see it had changed while she was gone. Viner turned down the radio and leaned an arm out at his window. A boy in a faded t-shirt came up and tugged at his hand, and Viner pulled it away. "Skittles?" the boy asked. "Shukran," he added. Viner could only shake his head. He knew the Marines made a point of handing out candy for the kids as they made their way around the city, but he hadn't thought to bring any. The boy didn't look too disappointed. He smiled and pumped his fist in the air. "USA," he said, lowering his voice to sound like a grown man. "USA." Viner grinned and looked over at Nima. "I was kind of hoping we'd be more inconspicuous. I guess I stand out like a sore thumb here." She smiled at him, but failed to meet his eyes. That was fine. His skin was itchy all over, and he didn't know how much of her gaze he could take. The traffic flowed into a roundabout and thinned down. He touched the gas and got them moving on a road that led generally in the direction of the airport. He would have loved to take the main highway that led right there. Route Irish, the troops called it. But Nemash shook her head and pointed deeper into the city. "It's the fastest way," she said. They passed by a little threadbare market, all plywood stalls selling fresh fruit and bags of rice. A narrow shop on the other side had no front wall. In the back, a television flickered restlessly, watched intently by rows of men on simple benches. A sporting event must have been on. As Viner passed, they rose as a single being and shouted and hugged each other. "Touchdown," he said. But Namal looked confused and he shrank down in his seat. On the next street, the sidewalks were almost bare, until the doors of a mosque opened and a flood of men came out, having finished their twilight prayers. They walked right out into the street, and Viner had to stop short or hit some of them. The men barely gave him a glance. He sat there, idling, while they crossed to the other side and filtered up and down the street, presumably back to their homes. He was about to put the car back in drive when one very old man stopped directly in front of his hood and turned from side to side as if he'd heard someone calling him. He had long white sideburns that stuck out from the sides of his face and a black skullcap chased with silver threads. When he turned to look right at the car, Viner saw that his eyes were white with cataracts. His face was as etched with lines as a river canyon. "Jesus," Viner said. The guy spooked him, made him jumpy. When the old man turned as if to stare at Nama, though he was obviously blind, the girl in the passenger seat squirmed and looked like she might jump out of the car. "Get us out of here," she hissed, and Viner hit his horn. The old man didn't flinch, but he did start to raise one hand. Suddenly there were young guys, teenagers some of them, with just faint hints of mustache on their faces all around. "Please," Nama said, grabbing the handle on her door. "Please go." Viner leaned on the horn and the younger guys started shouting and hurrying about. He threw the car in drive and swerved around the old man. It looked for a second like the young man would mob the car, but Viner remembered what he'd been taught. He kept the vehicle moving and just shoved his way through. Someone slapped the trunk noisily, but they didn't chase him once he was past. "You want to tell me what that was about?" Viner asked, sparing the occasional glimpse at Nama as he gunned through a deserted alley. On either side, he saw the back of halal butcher shops. A goat was being slaughtered in one stall, its throat cut while the butcher constantly washed its face and head with water from a hose. Blood slicked the asphalt and was probably gumming up the car's tires. Nama didn't answer him, just shook her head from side to side again and again. "Is it because you're not wearing a headscarf? Is that what freaked those guys out? Is it because you're riding with me?" He frowned and blinked his eyes. "Are you going to get in trouble because they saw you?" She stopped shaking her head. Was that a yes? He cursed under his breath. She had nothing to worry about on that front, he knew. In a little bit, they would get to her house, and then neither of them would have anything to worry about. If she panicked and jumped out of the car before he got here, however, things could go to hell very fast. "It's going to be okay. I'll protect you," he insisted. She favored him with a weary smile. They passed back out into a crowded main street where a juggler was entertaining a crowd that spilled out into the road. A group of women in long black dresses laughed and squawked and jumped back as the car rolled past them. Viner kept his speed low but steady. A line of cars ahead was waiting to turn into a side street, blocking his lane. He watched what the other drivers were doing, then slipped past the line the same way, one set of tires up on a half-empty sidewalk. They passed a shoe store that took up most of a block full of shoppers. Another block on, and they saw a hospital that had been badly damaged by artillery shells. Its roof had caved in, and all its windows were broken. Pigeons roosted in the scorched timbers. At the next corner stood a man who wasn't smiling or waving. He was speaking into a cell phone he held to his ear with both hands. Around his neck was a weird kind of necklace, a thick, rolled-up piece of metal, lead maybe, hanging on a leather thong. As the car passed him, he turned as if he didn't want to look at it, but when they'd passed, Viner saw him sneaking a peek at their license plate. It could mean anything. Most likely it meant nothing. Sweat rolled down Viner's back. What would Holcomb do, he wondered. What would the nameless contractor have done? Viner took the next right and then a left to get on a parallel road. "Where are you going?" Nama asked, suddenly finding her voice again. "Just being careful. We'll be back on the main road in a minute." Among the many pieces of advice Holcomb had given him was that whenever he felt paranoid, he was doing the right thing. Getting off the main road had seemed like overkill, but maybe he was just being smart. Then he saw a pile of trash in the middle of the street ahead of him. It didn't look like it had been dumped there and just ignored. It was blocking the thoroughfare, and he would have to drive through it if he wanted to proceed. It looked like piles of rags and some empty crates that had once held oranges. Hidden in the middle were some black plastic garbage bags. He looked around and saw there was nobody, nobody, on the sidewalks on either side. "Shit," he said. "I thought I was being smart. Hold on." He braked, stopped the car, threw it in reverse. There was probably nothing up there but a pile of trash. It could also have been an IED. He'd read about those in Newsweek. Bombs made out of mortar rounds wired to a cell phone. If he got too close, somebody in a nearby building would make a quick call and the explosives would go off, shredding the car and its occupants. A proper convoy of military vehicles would have people trained in how to detect and remotely trigger an IED. Some of them had cell phone jammers on board that could keep the spotter from making the deadly call. All Viner had was a bad feeling. He stepped on the gas and then braked immediately. A big truck had come up behind him even as he was putting the car in reverse. It filled the narrow street. There was no way he could reverse around it. "Oh no," he said, "not like this." He didn't want to die like this. He hit his horn, again and again, hoping the truck would back up. It didn't. Up ahead of them, somebody threw more garbage bags on the pile. Viner tried backing up a little to see if the truck would budge, but it didn't move at all. The truck driver blasted him with a much louder horn as if they were playing a game. The contractor's pistol was in his pocket. Could he shoot his way out of this? As men in jumpsuits leapt off the side of the truck, he reached for the gun, which felt warm in his hand. "Jesus, no," he thought. The jumpsuited men walked casually past the car. They started grabbing up trash from the pile. Then they walked back to the truck. Their garbage truck. They threw the plastic bags in the back, then went back for a second load. They didn't even look inside the car. Viner laid his head down on the steering wheel and breathed a long sigh of relief. In a few minutes, the garbage men had the pile sorted out, and the truck's horn blasted him again, making him jump, but just a little. Viner put the car in gear and accelerated up the now clear street. The route Namas suggested took them briefly along a curve of the Tigris River. They passed through an industrial zone that was almost deserted in the thickening night, the only movement on the sidewalks, the swaying of the palm trees and the power lines overhead. At one point, the road widened out and they were rolling past a gigantic train yard full of rusting boxcars and switching gear. Looming above it were vast cranes and scaffolding around an unfinished mosque. It was huge, bigger than any church Viner had ever seen in the States, a dust-colored, colossal tombstone looming over an empty part of town. Viner saw a pair of strikers up ahead. Two shovel-nosed, eight-wheeled monstrosities, their sides covered in cages of steel pipes to catch rocket-propelled grenades. Soldiers wearing colorless, blotchy uniforms and night-vision goggles were fanning out around the vehicles, obviously looking for someone or something. A team of counterinsurgency specialists was up against the wall of a clapboard house just across the tracks, pounding on the door with a battering ram. Overhead, a helicopter hung motionless in the cooling air, showing no lights at all. Viner took a turn off to get away from them. He didn't want to be stopped, not now when he'd come so far. He didn't want to have to answer any uncomfortable questions. Beyond the train yard was a zone of orchards, the trees looking dusty and gray in the darkness. Light manufactories and artisan shops dominated. There were fewer and fewer lights in the buildings and on the street. The people out here tended to dress more traditionally. He saw them drinking tea out of tall glasses at tiny little cafes, saw them gathering to talk in the street. A lot of them were armed, but they waved at him and he guessed that was okay. The buildings around the orchards were made of mud or were shacks cobbled together from random building supplies. "This is more what I expected," he said. Namas stirred in the seat next to him. Had she been sleeping? She was leaning on her door, her head pressed up against the windowsill. "What do you mean?" she asked, looking out at the street. "It looks old," he said, "and, you know, poor." She laughed softly. This city was old before Muhammad was born. There was a time this was the largest and most opulent city in the world. Saddam tried to cover all its centuries with his gold leaf and pictures of himself, but the real Baghdad is not so easily disguised. It's not much farther to the... A bullet passed through the car right in front of Viner's face. It dug a bright gouge through Naman's headrest. She shrieked and he let out a roaring sound he barely recognized as his own voice. He grabbed tight at the wheel and stamped on the accelerator, having no idea what was going on. He looked over but didn't see any blood on her. Then he thought to look down, but he didn't see any blood on himself either. "What the?" he had time to say before another bullet pierced the hood of the car. White smoke jumped out of the hole. What the hell was he supposed to do? Holcomb hadn't prepared him for this. He heard automatic gunfire, a series of quick, flat noises coming from his left. The street he was on ran straight as an arrow for another quarter mile before ending in a roundabout. He would be a sitting duck for the whole length of it. There was a burnt-out villa on the right, a side away from the machine gun. Up ahead, a row of 50-gallon barrels had been pushed out into the street. A boy with a torch lit them until yellow flames jumped from their tops. Woven between them were very simple barricades, logs planed down and studded with blunt metal spikes. A striker could have rolled right over that, probably, but there was no way Viner would drive through that without destroying a car. Bullets struck the back of the car, made it shake and toss. Viner saw men in long robes running alongside, running toward the car, all of them armed. He floored the gas pedal and swerved off to the right, screaming at Naman to jump out as soon as the car had stopped. He switched off the headlights and jumped out himself, then ran as fast as he could toward the destroyed villa. Bullets whizzed past. He had no way of telling how far away. He crouched to duck under a fallen girder in the ruin and pressed himself close into a shadow that stank like an old campfire. Had he made the right decision to get away from the car? He had no idea. It had made sense at the time. He couldn't see Nama. He couldn't hear her over the noise of his own breathing. Viner tried to get control of himself. He took the handgun out of his pocket and slipped off the safety. He'd wondered if he could shoot his way out of the hypothetical ambush before. It looked like he might get a chance to find out. The villa must have been hit by a stray bomb, he decided, looking around. The roof had caved in like a great conical pit, pushing all the furnishings and much of the structure back towards the walls. Ahead of him, through the darkened mess at the center of the house, lay a corridor that was still mostly intact. Some of its windows weren't even broken, and light streamed in through a lonely street lamp. He thought he saw a shadow over there, shaped like a woman, but he just didn't know if it was Nama or a trick of the light. Moving step by step, testing each foothold before he put any weight on it, he moved deeper into the house, away from the street. Maybe there was a functional back door. His foot nearly skidded on a pile of old women's magazines. He could still make out some of the titles, Vogue Paris, Cosmopolitan, Hello. He took another step, and then froze in place. A man wearing a blazer over his dishdasha had come inside the ruin. He had an AK-47 strapped across his chest and his eyes glinted in the darkness. He looked back over his shoulder and gestured at someone behind him. Viner heard a group of people arguing in Arabic. He didn't move. He breathed through his mouth. The guy in the blazer had a flashlight. He switched it on and swept it around the interior of the villa, lighting up piles of rubble, torn upholstery, heaps of broken glass. The light touched a painting of a man in a military uniform, his chest covered in medals. Someone had cut through his face with a knife. If the light came any closer to Viner, if it caught him, he would just start shooting and hope for the best. He readied himself for the eventuality, but then his heart stopped when the light turned in the other direction and passed right over Nama's face. She was standing perfectly still on top of a gilt coffee table. Her eyes didn't move as the light strayed across her cheek, her thin nose. She was looking right at Viner with that same piercing look she'd always had. Then the flashlight passed on. Nobody said anything, no alarm was raised. The guy with the flashlight stepped back. Could it be that Nama had set Viner up? Was she working with these killers? Had she led him right into a trap? No, he didn't believe that, not for a second. The men near the front of the villa moved around, making room for someone coming up. A new light, flickering in a breeze, came forward, and Viner wondered if they were going to torch the villa and burn him out. The procession that came forward startled him. At its head came a man, almost certainly some kind of priest, dressed in a spotless white robe and enormous white turban. He was carrying a huge braided candle in his hands. That was the source of the flickering light. It gave off an intense, pungent smoke, a little like incense. Behind the priest came a boy wearing a black robe. His head was bare, and his hair fell past his shoulders in thick, dark ringlets. He was holding a terracotta bowl, big enough to make a salad in. Arabic and Hebrew characters lined the inside of the bowl, lines of text written in a double spiral pattern that started or ended at the center. Both the boy and the priest wore necklaces like the one he'd seen before, what felt like hours ago, an amulet of rolled-up lead sagging on a thong. Viner had no idea who they were. The men behind the priest were singing now, a low, measured hymn. The sound of it made Viner's head hurt. He could hear Nama moving in the dark, stepping backwards away from the weird procession. He thought maybe she was calling his name, but he couldn't hear anything but the singing. Any second now, that candle would be close enough to light up his face, and he knew he didn't want that. He moved fast, trying to strike like a cat. He stumbled forward over broken concrete and grabbed the candle and threw it away from him. It went out instantly. He reached past the priest and grabbed the bowl the boy was holding and smashed it against the stub of a scorched wall. What he did next had to be instinctive, because he didn't remember thinking it through. With one arm, he grabbed the boy around the neck, pulling him tight against his chest. With his other hand, still holding his gun, he fired a shot into the roof that made soot come cascading down. A dozen flashlight beams were on him instantly, but before anyone could shoot him, he had the barrel of the pistol shoved into the boy's ear. Everyone stopped moving. Everyone stared right at him. Viner took a step forward, pushing the boy ahead of him. The boy grabbed at his arm, but couldn't get free. Viner was holding on for dear life and wasn't about to let go. He took another step, keeping the gun right where it was. The man in the blazer, the one with the AK-47, took a step backward and raised his hands. He said something soft and pleading, but Viner didn't understand a word. Viner walked all the way back out to the street like that, holding the boy. He hoped Nama would follow him, but he didn't have time to look back and see if she did or not. "Get those barrels and crap out of the way," he shouted. The men all stared at him. He repeated himself, then squeezed the boy tighter until he screamed. The men rushed to the flaming barricade. They kicked over the barrels and shoved them into the gutters, rolled the timbers to one side. Viner pulled the boy into his car, shoving him awkwardly into the space between the two front seats. He heard the passenger side door open and then slam, closed, and saw Nama sitting next to him. Fine. He drove for a mile without saying a word to anyone. Then he stopped and shoved the boy out into the street. The boy shouted something rhythmic and repetitive. It sounded like a prayer, Viner thought, though not an Islamic one. He ignored the boy and kept driving. Who were they? He asked Nama. He had a feeling she knew more than he did about what had just happened. He thought, no, he knew. The men and the children had been after her and not him. And that wasn't the only weird thing. The man in the blazer had pointed his flashlight right at her and seen nothing. She had been invisible to him. Viner thought of the guards at the Assassin's Gate. They hadn't seen her either. The only person who had acknowledged her existence all day, other than Viner, was a blind man. If that candle had lit her up, what would have happened? Who were they? He demanded again. Shiites? Sunnis? Sabians, she told him. Gnostics. They worshipped John the Baptist, but not Jesus. He squinted at her. What? This was a place of tolerance once, she told him. All were welcome and there was no persecution. Once. Then she felt silent. He asked her a million more questions, but she answered none of them. Something was wrong with his head. He couldn't clear the smell of the candle's smoke out of his throat and sinuses. He could still see its light. It made it hard to think straight. Soon he stopped asking her questions, stopped talking at all. He would find out what he needed to know in all due time, at Nama's house. The city fell away piece by piece. Vacant lots started appearing on either side, then became common, then predominated, until they were driving through a zone of suburban houses. Then those fell away, too. Soon they were driving through isolated farms and settlements, little clusters of shacks. Then there was nothing. Unbroken save for the very occasional poplar tree or a stunted, flayed-looking palm, the desert opened up before the car, ribboned here and there with canals that caught the moon. A jackal ran alongside the road, keeping pace with the car for a while. Its eyes shone when it looked at them. Nama looked back and made cooing noises at it. Viner was beginning to get scared. Not of her. He could overpower her easily, stop the car anywhere, do what he needed to do, cut out those damned eyes of hers so she never looked into his soul again. No, he was afraid of the country around him, of its secrets. Nama's house wasn't very far from the city, not in miles. It looked much as she had described it, a small stone building with a walled courtyard. A fountain in said courtyard. Except she hadn't told him it was in ruins. Sand had worn the broken walls down to nubs like scoured bones. The fountain was full of dust, and the garden had withered and rotted away centuries before he arrived. He stopped the car. They got out. Nama came toward him, her hair flapping in the desert wind, and kissed him hard on the mouth. Something broke inside him before she stepped away. His soul? His will? He knew he'd lost something in that kiss. He knew she'd led him all this way just to take it from him. She ran into the courtyard and kneeled in the dirt next to the dry, dry fountain. Here, she said. Dig here. There was no shovel, not even a trowel. He didn't know why he obeyed her, but he scratched and clawed at the earth with his fingers. Soon he'd uncovered something sharp-edged and hard. He dug some more, cleared the dirt away, and found himself holding a bowl. A terracotta bowl inscribed on the inside with Arabic and Hebrew and Greek characters, letters and alphabets he didn't even recognize. The bowl shook in his hands, or were his arms just trembling? "Break it!" she howled. "Shatter it!" He lifted the bowl and then brought it down hard on the edge of the fountain. It cracked a little but didn't break. He hit it again and the fountain's lip broke off, but the bowl shattered in his hands into useless, meaningless pieces. Behind him there were two women, then. He turned to look. He saw Nama, and standing next to her, a woman who he thought must be her sister. There was a distinct family resemblance. "She is called Lilith," Nama said. He was kneeling before them. He could not rise to his feet. Nama bent over and kissed the top of his head. "Are you going to kill me?" he asked then. He could not have stopped them. He couldn't even feel his fingers or his toes. The women laughed. "Don't you know why I seduced you, Viner?" Nama asked. "You're an evil man. A murderer, yes?" "Yes," he said. He could not lie. She'd already seen through him. "And now you're going to be our husband. Our mate." Lilith shrugged her shoulders, and a pair of owl's wings flicked out from her back. Viner touched his forehead to the dirt between their feet. It was the only thing he could do. with special thanks to Charles Habero and Muddy Dog.